a description of her, which is written in large print, so I don't need my over 60s glasses. Melissa Schur. She has both a master's in social work and an MPH from the University of North Carolina. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in Armenia in 94, and since then she has worked in over 20 countries in Africa, Asia, and the former Soviet Union. She's also now with JSI and working on the 8-STAR-1 HIV care and support issues. And she's going to talk to us about a traditional essential drug, which is now, even though it's out of patent, become a new essential drug. Hi, everyone. I think I can whip through this pretty fast because a lot of the key issues that are coming up for Clostamoxifil were also already discussed by my colleagues. So as many of you probably know, Clostamoxifil is a simple, well-tolerated, inexpensive antibiotic, and when taken regular as a prophylaxis among people living with HIV, it can reduce mortality and risk of pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, and other opportunistic infections. In 2006, WHO established that Clostamoxifil was part of the HIV chronic care package, and it's key to improving the health of people living with HIV/AIDS, and particularly to pre-antiretroviral therapy. So at that time, the whole reconceptualization of Clostamoxifil changed. What we did, and again, Paula Nersesian was the lead investigator and author on this study, so it's great that she's here to answer any questions. What we were getting is anecdotal results that the Clostamoxifil that was prioritized for HIV care was getting used by in primary healthcare settings. So PEPFAR wanted us to do a 15-country study to look at what the situation was in those countries, and also to look at access to Clostamoxifil among people living with HIV/AIDS. So the countries that we selected at the time, 8-STAR-1 was primarily working with the PEPFAR countries, the 15 that were selected by President Bush many years ago that have since changed. So that's who the countries that we've talked to. Botswana, Ethiopia, Cote d'Ivoire, Kenya, Mozambique, Namibia, Nigeria, Rwanda, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia, and the rest of the world, which means Haiti, Guyana, and Vietnam. The methodology that was used was we completed a study actually in 2010, and the report was published in January 2011. And most of the information was collected via desk review and interviews with key stakeholders in all of those countries, and also here, the project support staff based in Washington, D.C., and of course, talking strongly with the SDMS partners, USAID, and CDC. The caveats, who we didn't talk to are some of the gaps in the findings were, there was no in-country follow-up, so we were just taking what people said without checking it. There was a lack of Ministry of Health participation in each of the countries. South Africa, the interview was only with CAPRISA, which is the Center for AIDS Program and Research in South Africa. That's just because we couldn't get anyone else to talk to us. And the information that we collected results really the best, our best efforts to do this from Washington, D.C. So the results are for each country. Each country has its own, like, two-page annex. So if you're interested in a particular country and the results, that's online, and you can just download Botswana or download Cote d'Ivoire. And get that information specifically. But we organized the report into these five categories. So looking at reported stockouts in all those countries, looking at information tracking, how they looked at Clostamoxifil use in HIV and in primary health care. That was actually the thing that came out of there. Some systems were integrated and some were separate. So the countries were mixed in how they marked it, or how they marked the use. When and how, looking at annually or monthly, how often they forecasted, and how collaboratively, if it was mixed primary health care and HIV, or if it was separately. The funding, who, all 15 countries reported the government funded, PEPFAR was reported by 12, Global Fund by 8, Unit Aid by 7, EU World Bank by 1, and that was Cote d'Ivoire, who had kind of a unique funding mechanism there. Procurement, who, the same players. Again, Cote d'Ivoire had CARE as well, so that was the only one. And Clinton, UNICEF, World Bank, and PEPFAR, and government. So the findings, one thing that came out, as my colleagues mentioned as well, is that for PEPFAR to purchase Cotrim and use it, it has to be FDA approved. However, there are a number of local manufacturers that countries use. So that was one of the things that people had to balance in country. For example, in Nigeria, there's a law that if the medicine is produced in the country, they must use it. But it didn't reach, it didn't make FDA requirements. So SCMS was able to reach a consensus with the government to import Cotrimoxazole for 2 years while they then worked with a local manufacturer to improve the product quality of the product that they had. The factors that influenced availability overall, we're looking at issues of integration and country ownership and then stakeholder participation. Again, there was a mix of being fully integrated into this national system, moving it into integration and logistics systems, and then having it still segregated. Interesting to note, the ones that were segregated, Cote d'Ivoire, Haiti, Rwanda, and Tanzania, reported more stockouts in Cotrimoxazole. The stakeholder participation, the higher level of coordination, the more people were able to access it. What is PEPFAR's role in Cotrimoxazole? And again, a lot of this is through SCMS, which again my colleagues talked about. They looked at three different ways. They were rather nimble in a way because they were able to look at routine, non-routine, and actually know Cotrim procurement support, but then providing technical assistance in terms of providing management support. So again, it's a way that they can work the system to provide what the country needs based on what the country wants and what their priorities are. This is one of the charts that's in the report, and this kind of shows the different areas, that the different funding sources that Cotrimoxazole was procured from, and how they go through the funding source to procurement, to distribution, and to the actual implementation at the sites. So if most of you are supply chain experts, you will love this slide, because it shows how complex it is and all the multiple arrows, and looking at, you know, private transport, public sector, and outsourcing it, and looking at who's doing what where. And Global Fund was put under the Ministry of Health because most of the Global Fund funding goes through that mechanism. Some of the challenges that the study found was, I think, something many of you are probably familiar with, the weak LMIS and parallel information management systems. For example, in Ethiopia, there was free, Cotrimoxazole is free for people living with HIV/AIDS, but it cost for primary health care. So that was one issue of having two different types of ways of managing that information. So one of the recommendations in the report was increasing the access and particularly focusing on looking at service delivery mechanisms that meet the customer requirements, addressing the needs of marginalized population. That means the most vulnerable and also geographically most vulnerable. As well, creating pricing to encourage adherence. So in a number of countries, the Cotrimoxazole was free for people living with HIV, so that's a way to encourage adherence to Cotrim and then further on to ART. Engage partners, again, improving the coordination and increasing the coverage. Another challenge that came out was ensuring access to the active ingredient. There's actually a monopoly on the active pharmaceutical ingredient for Cotrim, and there's no danger. I don't think there was any danger. It didn't flag anything, but it's just important to note because it could create problems going forward. And also looking at the local Cotrimoxazole manufacturing and the quality questions and making sure that the local Cotrim manufacturers are meeting FDA requirements, because it really saves in cost and it's much more sustainable to support those systems imported in. The recommendation on that, again, was improving the quality and looking at mechanisms to provide technical assistance to the local manufacturers. So that's a picture, because my slides have no pictures. So you can see the difference, though, in terms of, really strong supply and looking at two different warehouses in two different countries and seeing just the diversity of what exists. Another challenge, of course, is securing financing. There's complicated donor coordination and funding restrictions. A lot of countries are receiving Cotrimoxazole from many different sources. And one example came out from Nigeria that in 2009 they actually had an overstock of Cotrimoxazole because it was funded through many different mechanisms. So then they responded to that by looking at funneling the HIV-designated Cotrimoxazole to primary health care. I just want to reinforce that that's not typical, that overstocks happen. example. Another challenge that appeared was overcoming procurement obstacles and looking at administrative barriers, importation waivers, and procurement delays. One example that came from Kenya looked at a lack of a reliable procurement system via the Global Fund, and they had numerous stock shortages that they reported through the last year or so of providing Cotramoxel. The recommendation is to improve the efficiency, streamlining the management, looking at integrated, segregated, and hybrid ways to do that, to collect that data and provide that information. And again, ensuring that the technical assistance and support we're giving the countries is tailored to their particular needs. The final challenge that we talked about, or that the report talks about, is looking at different ways to distribute the product effectively, and that kind of was reinforced by my colleagues here. Looking at geographic barriers and insufficient resupply information and space limitations. Also reinforced here, one of the country examples from Vietnam, the pediatric syrup is not available in some of the more remote geographically areas because, as David said, suppliers refuse to ship small doses because there's very low demand, so stockouts were quite frequent for pediatric Cotramoxacil syrup supplies in Vietnam. So some of the recommendations to improve the coordination are similar to what we've already said, improving service delivery, improving the logistical management information system, looking at quantification and making sure people know how to do it accurately, and financing. So the next steps, what ASTAR 1, again, this report came out in January 2011, so what we've done from that in terms of to try and increase the use is we've developed educational materials for clients and for providers as well that try to increase the demand and increase the prescription of Cotramoxacil. And these materials look at identifying the benefits. They're made for low literacy populations, how and when to take it, and when to seek care in the presence of side effects. And so we're hoping to pilot out these materials in Uganda this year. And there's a range of materials, pamphlets and posters with dosing charts, and also job aids for health professionals, health workers in the community level, and also at the clinic. And for more information, please just visit the website. All these tools and report is downloadable on ASTAR.
Thank you. We have somebody in the front row playing music for us now. Just for those of you who came in later, if anyone would like to be on our pharmaceuticals interest email list, it's very low traffic. I know you all get too much email traffic. Just give me your business card. Now, we're running up close to the end of time, but I think we can keep the room for a little while, so I'd like to open it up for questions. Yes?
My name is Jennifer.
Well, they're all available if you've paid an APHA fee to see them afterwards, I believe, right? Yeah. But if you didn't pay that fee, I should probably not be saying this, but you could probably give your business card to that person whose presentation you'd like. Yeah. I think we have at least two panelists that might be able to speak to that, some of those issues. I don't think we have a portable.
Why don't I just stand up?
Yeah,
that would work. Thank you for the question. At the global level, it's difficult, I think, to talk in terms of pilot studies because it's a pilot study is not relevant to trying to get more supply from to enhance the supplier base. What is happening at the global level is a much enhanced level of collaboration between the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator, OGAC for PEPFAR, and the Global Fund. And certainly I do know that there are intense discussions going on following the high-level panel report of the high-level panel to the Global Fund, and better integration there. In terms of the, you mentioned advanced market commitments, the structure of PEPFAR, and particularly the structure that we're able to operate under SCMS, does enable us to place some pretty strong advance commitments. We are not dependent on particular budgets in particular countries, so there is a flow there, and I think that that's something that the Global Fund needs to look at, that most of their purchases are still what we call spot purchases. If the money is available, the principal recipient will make the purchase and get them shipped in, and it might be a year or 18 months of supply. That's not sensible supply chain management. You need it staggered, and you need a longer term commitment, and I think that's an area that at a policy level does need to be looked at. Where the piloting could come in is perhaps more in country with good practice on coordination between the different donors that are working together, and what we've just heard about cotrimoxazole, I think that's where we have to try and work there. So that's they're still pretty general statements, I'm afraid.
Yes, David.
Yeah, I have a dream. I World Health money from a nonprofit, and what we've done is we contracted with UPS, and they ship the toothbrushes, and then we contracted with Federal Express, and they ship the toothpaste, and then we contracted with the post office, and they ship the mouthwash. Now, it's even better, because when it gets to the end place where the people need to get their teeth fixed, there's one free place, okay, but you got to have a canker sore to get the stuff there. And if you don't have a canker sore, you got to go to one of the other clinics, and then you have to pay for it, and they can't afford it. So I think this is, oh, by the way, they take 80 to 100% overhead, each of them, before they even move a pencil. Okay? So I think this is a really good model. I thought it was until I heard you guys talk, and I realized you've adopted the model. And that each person's supply chain is unique, and that even though there's drugs that need to be used for the same disease in different places, they're distributed in different clinics. And even though you obviously shipped on trucks and warehouses, which could be used for all three of you's problems, okay? You don't do that. So I thought I had a really unique idea, but I see that you've adopted it. And so the question is, how can you un-F it up and start to talk to each other about more efficiently doing this work together, and not ignoring, and by the way, the education thing is interesting, because we do the same thing. Rather than educate people to read and write, okay, which might allow them to do things on their own, we send them pictures, and we send them pictures for each disease, and at the end of that process, they still can't read and write. Okay, and so because reading and writing, that's really hard to do, where we can spend a lot of money on nonprofits to do picture programs. So that's another thing you might think of adopting, rather than encouraging people to educate in each country, at least to say the sixth grade level, like they did in that place called Cuba in about a year and a half. Those are my ideas, but I guess you haven't heard.
If I understand, David, you're talking a lot about the parallel systems, which is a very interesting complex topic, but I think maybe we can't deal with that right now. Thank you for your comments.
Just a suggestion.
I'd just like to ask David the question about availability, given the fact that treatments will continue to be used as prevention, and demand is going to outstrip need, and if you could comment on where you think things are going with that.
Yeah, it's a worry, and the biggest challenge at the moment is that the unpredictability of the availability of sufficient funding to reach those levels of those higher levels towards 13 million or 15 million on treatment in 3 or 4 years. There isn't sufficient confidence in the market at the moment that funding will be there to get to those levels. So without confidence that funding will be there, the manufacturers are not going to invest in new capacity. And the biggest, the most acute challenge we foresee at the moment is probably on tenofovir, that we think by the end of 2012, 2013, if we continue to recruit patients at the level we're doing at the moment, we will reach pretty close to the limits of the API production. Formulation's less of a problem if you can get the incentives right, because formulation is less unique. But the API has to start earlier, and we talk with the suppliers. But I can't give any greater assurance that Global Fund money or PEPFAR money is going to be at the level necessary to bring that number of people on treatment. I think that's the tightest area. We know the pressure points through the supply chain. It's getting that confidence that the financial market, the financial support is there to the market.
So do you envision that the number of new patients put on medicines will be restricted in some way so as to be able to continue providing medicines to those that are there?
That's a policy decision above my pay grade, and I am very careful not to tread into that those shark-infested waters. But the priority is always to keep existing patients on treatment. Whether we will see a slowdown, I don't know. Last year, 2010, there was 10% less money went to HIV/AIDS, and we brought on more people on treatment than we've ever done before. So there's still more we can do in the efficiency of how we use the money. But there's pressure, new prevention medicines, the microbicides that I was speaking of earlier, the money going into medical male circumcision, these sorts of things. So, there are some very difficult decisions being made by the funders.
This is for the malaria trial. Can you tell us I know that we always look at benefit versus risk. But has there been any consideration or looked at the possible impact on the exposure to pesticides, with the next and spring plants in that?
There's been a lot of research into that. I actually don't know that much about it. We don't handle insecticides except to treat in nets. And actually, the bigger concern right now is that there's resistance to the pesticides that are being used that it's developing. So there's concerns about how long they can continue with the pyrethroids, which is the insecticide that they are using currently. And there is benefit and risk. To humans, very little risk. The bigger issue might be to the other creatures around us in terms of the insecticide.
This is a question for Paul specifically. My name is Allison. I work with JSI in Boston. So I'm wondering how the rise and expansion of MDR-TB and XDR-TB has impacted the focus and the landscape of R&D for TB drugs in recent years, and if there is a plan and what it is for like a 5 to 10 year long-term strategy for
It's a very good question, and one of the studies that I pointed to, the new combination, is actually able to address rifampin resistance, and that's very close in the development pipeline to being approved. It looks very promising, and the person who asked the other question, the FDA co-development guidelines have helped move that process along. Clearly, more and better treatments for MDR-TB are needed. The pipeline does address more products for resistance because resistance to isoniazid and rifampin are two of the key, which are two of the key drugs for treatment of drug-sensitive TB, need to be replaced as they're becoming obsolete in so many cases. XDR is a little more complicated because you require something other than fluoroquinolone because that's what marks XDR-TB, resistance to a fluoroquinolone, and it's to very promising drugs that I commented on, gadafloxacin and moxifloxacin, are both fluoroquinolones. So people with XDR remain in dire circumstances, but I'm hopeful that before the middle of this decade, we'll have some additional options for drug-resistant TB.
Yes.
Hi, my question is for Melissa. Did you share back the results of your assessment with the countries, and did the countries take any action based on your recommendations?
Yeah, we did share back the report with all of the countries that we interviewed, and I do not know if any of them have taken any action based on the recommendations.
And if I could just add to that, it's so easy to hope that they would take a document and act on the recommendations therein, but it really requires pointed attention, resources, technical assistance, and support over a longer period of time, because many of the problems that were identified through that study are common, protracted, long-term problems that affect not only cotrimoxazole, but many of the essential medicines within the basket of medicines that are needed to treat common, prevailing, pervasive diseases in the country beyond AIDS, TB, and malaria.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Maura. I'm actually also from JSI in Boston. Many of the presentations discussed the issues around pediatric radiation and all the challenges around that, both in terms of the doses, but also in terms of actually how children are receiving them and if they'll take the bad taste and whatnot. Are there any new initiatives or anything going on to sort of overcome those challenges that any of you are aware of and can share with us?
Within TB, I can say there is something of a movement to try to bring more advocacy and development to issues around pediatric formulations, but you have to remember that they are a less well-represented group from an advocacy point of view. They don't have the voice to represent themselves like adults and others who find it more compelling. So there is something of a movement forward to address some of those issues, but it's not as robust as is needed. David?
Yeah, in the ARV field, the three big buyers, ourselves, CHAI, and the Global Fund, are working closely together to coordinate our purchasing so that we will collectively place orders together once a quarter. So that consolidates our demand and gets most of the products, gets that to a level that is commercially viable for a manufacturer to run a new batch that satisfies each of our orders. So that level of coordination is going on. There's also work going on with WHO and UNAIDS, which all of us are contributing to better optimize the use of the products so we reduce the fragmentation of demand. And there are some new fixed dose combinations coming on board. Strangely, it seems to be hard to get the fixed dose combinations adopted in country. But there are a number of countries where they've been available, and the uptake has been really slow, which is very odd when you think, well, why don't you do that? But we don't quite understand why that is yet. So there's some. Open some movement in the ARV side. In the longer term, we hope that this market will get smaller and get even more challenging as PMTCT works and the number of infected kids reduces. So suppliers are looking at that and thinking, this market may not be here in 10 years or it'll be half the size. I hope that's right, but it gives us a further challenge.
We should really vacate the room for the next group, but if there's one more question. Yeah? Okay, great. Thank you so much, all of you.